voice of reason in the medical world. Dr. Fred Brown from Griffin Health talks to Melissa in the morning on WICC 600.
Okay. So, Dr. Brown, I need your help this morning because I did a little research. I did a little, I'll just say a little polling on my end. Last week, you talked about the fact that most of the patients you're seeing at Griffin, we're hearing it from Bridgeport Hospital as well, Greenwich Hospital, Stanford Hospital, I'm sure many others, that most of the people going in fighting COVID right now are in their mid-50s or younger. So I did a little work. And I found out some of the biggest reasons why the younger population of Connecticut residents are not getting the vaccine. And I need your help to try and convince people otherwise. Are you going to help me?
Absolutely.
Can you help me? Okay.
Absolutely, Melissa.
Okay. First of all, this is the number one thing I have heard from friends of mine or just acquaintances who I've asked why they won't get the vaccine. It's not FDA approved.
Okay. That's interesting. So it is FDA approved. That's actually not correct. It is FDA approved. It is FDA approved, and I think this is where people are getting confused. It's FDA approved under the Emergency Use Authorization Act. And just so you understand sort of the history of the EUA, an EUA was actually designed after 9/11. And one of the concerns was is that there was the inability to get new or meaningful products out into the market in a timely manner to deal with national disasters. And so this piece of, I guess, legislation came out to make sure that anything that went through a regulatory body was gone through in a safe and effective manner, but sort of the red tape was taken out of it. So all the extra bureaucracy was taken out. And you can see, and I think this is where the listeners need to understand, you can see that it has not necessarily been easy for people to just get certain medications or even vaccines, in and out in the market, because they've actually had to go through a pretty rigorous ordeal through the FDA to get this approved. So again, it is a different approval, but it still would fit into the category of FDA approved.
Okay. So when it's an emergency, I think that's where people feel like when they hear emergency, I think they may get the wrong idea thinking, okay, we rushed the process, but it was not rushed. Like we didn't cut corners or overlook certain things that we would in a non-emergency situation. They still went through everything. They just went at a faster speed. Is that what happened?
Exactly.
Okay.
So there's interesting enough, and again, I do a little bit of a lecture on this, but essentially what happens is that every time a new medication, including a vaccine, comes onto the market, you have to go through clinical trials. And what happens is those clinical trials are very stepwise. So you have to do this step, and then you have to do that step, and then you have to do another step, and now you're ready to actually get into the market, and that's a whole, that continues to be the last step to continue to monitor while it's out in the market. So it's technically still being studied, and that's why you'll hear, certain things like the efficacy and how well it's working with variants, because now we're continuing to monitor that. Those steps, I wouldn't say have necessarily been condensed. Those steps have actually been overlapped, and that's why it's been quicker. And then the other piece that's really interesting, especially with vaccines, is that vaccines take a long time to develop because by the time you get through the numerous steps to get to the market, you have to have it manufactured also. And manufacturing is a big deal in itself. For myself, I focus sort of on the science side, the genetics, the mRNA. But again, we have engineers that are saying, okay, well, this needs to be done at this temperature, and we need to mass produce this, and this is how do we make sure that it's safe and effective, and we get enough, and we get it delivered, and what temperature. All those things were going on at the exact same time, which is really unheard of, and that's why it was able to come out this fast.
Dr. Brown, do we have another example? Just because I know you said that they passed having these like emergency orders for the FDA approval. They passed that back when 9/11 happened. So, like, do we have another example that maybe people just didn't even realize that it also had FDA emergency approval?
I the only things I can think of is actually related to other medications during the COVID-19.
Okay.
So some of the antivirals that we're using, so remdesivir is actually through an emergency use authorization. We actually give a monoclonal antibody if someone ends up getting sick and we're concerned that they're going to get sicker. That's also through emergency use authorization.
That's interesting. Yeah.
So there's a lot. Yeah, there's a lot of medications that are there, but there's also a lot of medications. And if you read the news, Pfizer came out with it, Merck came out with it. There's a tablet that in oral form, so something that you could take by mouth that actually can fight the virus. And early studies are showing that it's really good. But I think this is the point: is that it's not on the market. We need it. We want it. But it actually needs to be thoroughly vetted, and that's what we're going through now. So again, not everything that says that it works is you know automatically putting put on the market.
Right. Right. Talking to Dr. Brown this morning, another thing that people bring up to me, and I could be misquoting you, so please, I have no problem with you correcting me. I am not the doctor you are. People say that this has not been tested enough to trust the COVID vaccine. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Didn't we talk about once on the show before that there are a lot of elements in these vaccines that have been tested and used in other either forms of medication or vaccines since the 90s? Didn't you tell me that?
That is exactly right.
Okay.
That, yeah. See,
so this
look.
Isn't all. Well, I listen. I do my research.
You don't need me anymore. You can just.
No, I do. And this is why I think it means a lot coming from you. But I was like, I think he is. Because I've said this argument to my friends. I'm like, this isn't out of nowhere. I just had an argument with one of my friends who's in the Army. And it's so funny because he's like, I've had every vaccination down the pipeline to go overseas to fight for our country. He goes, but I won't touch the COVID vaccine because we don't know what's in it. And I'm like. No, I was told that most of the things in these vaccines have been used since the mid-90s.
That's exactly right. So we've been working with this technology since the 90s. And if they're ever interested, you can always look online and just look up companies that use mRNA technology. And the list is enormous. And these companies have been around for a long time. And it's been used. We've been using this as a mechanism to try to treat cancer, and to introduce different things to relieve people of certain types of diseases.
Wow!
So this research has actually been around for a long mRNA technology, mRNA utilization, and having the immune system develop certain types of proteins. And that's what we're doing with this vaccine, by developing certain types of proteins. This has been going on for, we've been doing this research since the 90s. It's been in human trials probably late 90s, and again, continue to be used to try to alleviate other types of diseases and illnesses in the body. And the other thing is that I know people, I've heard this a lot, that nobody knows what's in it. And, and we know what's in it. It's really mRNA and... It's really mRNA and just minimal ingredients to keep it stabilized. There's really not, if you look at this vaccine versus other vaccines, at least the mRNA vaccines, if you look at this vaccine versus other vaccines, this vaccine could be in the category of, I like to call it, limited ingredient. It doesn't have that much in it.
It's the mRNA. I think it's the mRNA that keeps throwing at everybody. But you know what's funny, Dr. Brown, is I feel like this is where education comes so in handy. Because, you know, to me, the fact that mRNA technology has been around for 30 years, give or take, I think we should have billboards all over the place saying, happy 30th birthday, mRNA. You've been around,
exactly.
Just no one talks
exactly.
about it. You know what I mean? Like that.
It's sort of interesting too, Melissa, is because vaccinations have been around since like 1796.
Right, right.
Edward Jenner.
Right.
This is not something new. And, you know, we have used, instead of having, it's almost interesting because I'm going to try to just sort of narrow it down and say, we've actually been using mRNA technology in vaccines. We've just sort of shortcutted directly to the mRNA. So we've given people vaccines, and when they get the vaccine, it actually activates the mRNA to produce the protein to get the desired effect.
Right,
so
right.
So we've actually been able to narrow that process down and just give the mRNA.
We've already talked about the idea of them thinking they're not FDA approved, which has been debunked, that these have not been tested enough to trust, also debunked. And I think the third biggest one, Dr. Brown, is concerns with pregnancies. There's a lot of misinformation going around about people in the next 8 to 10 years. If they want to get pregnant, it's not going to happen. In fact, my own sister, who works in healthcare, has been told by her clients before that, oh, are you and your future husband looking to ever have kids, it's not going to happen because you already got the vaccine. And my sister's like, where do you get your information? So I didn't know if you had any clarity on pregnancies, whether you are currently trying or you are pregnant, and for people who are looking to someday be a parent in the next 5 to 10 years.
So it's interesting, and I have a long story associated with that, but I won't give it to you because we don't have the time. But ultimately, you know, two things that happen is that people who are concerned about infertility, they go on to social media, they go on to Facebook, and they say, you know, does this cause long-term fertility? And what happens is they end up linking in with other people who actually are of the same concern, and then it sort of is a self-fulfilling prophecy where you end up continuing to hear the same thing. So the answer is that there's no reason to think. I mean, listen, nothing's 100%, but I mean, it's very, very, very unlikely that this vaccine would cause infertility. There's no cross-reactivity. It's producing a protein that is virus-specific. So it's not producing a protein that is even close to anything that we have in our body. So the whole infertility issue, and I know there's different discussions of why the whole infertility issue I don't think it's the case at all. So I think people who are worried about, you know, getting pregnant in the future or having children, this is not designed to inhibit it. It wouldn't work in that way. A lot more vaccines that we've received in the past have a lot more complexity than this does, and we've not had any issues with fertility with those. And then, you know, if it makes people feel better, there are animal models that also demonstrate that that's not an issue.
Okay. Well, we appreciate that.
That's the first one.
Yeah.
The second thing is the pregnancy. So pregnancy, there has been some data that's recently come out, I believe, by Pfizer that's demonstrating safety in pregnancy. There is actually two pieces with pregnancy. One is that, you know, it's definitely the data is showing that there's a safety associated with it. There's another concern that people need to be aware about. Pregnant women are actually at a higher risk of getting severe illness from COVID-19.
Okay.
And that becomes a big issue. And that severe illness could lead to, you know, severe complications, including, you know, psychiatric and neurologic issues, could lead to fetal demise. So there's some really severe things. So again, pregnant females really should be getting it. This has been recommended by the CDC. It's actually been recommended by the Professional Organization of Obstetrics and Gynecology. So this is definitely a recommendation for those who are pregnant.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, that's new information to me. I appreciate that. Now, what about the parents who have kids already? So switching gears a little bit, you know, we're starting to see that more of the vaccine companies are coming out with vaccines that work for younger children. And I know that we're in clinical trials right now, so it's a little too soon to say. But I know that the goal here, I know, Dr. Brown, is to eventually get kids as young as 6 months old to start getting vaccinated for COVID. So here's my concern, if I'm allowed to just be, you know, a parent for a second. I think a lot of people worry when you hear about vaccines for little kids, especially when you hear that it's only good for 6 months. Why is it so necessary, especially for little kids, to get them vaccinated? Because I got to be honest, I'm on the fence to feeling like, I don't know if I really want Chase to get the COVID vaccine.
Understood. So it's going to be really interesting. And we do know, I mean, it's sort of interesting because we know a couple things, especially what's going on right now. We do know that children can get they can get COVID-19.
Mm-hmm.
And we do know that even though the percentage is way lower, that there could be some side effects to actually getting COVID-19. And the more people who actually end up getting infected, you know, the more you're going to see those complications. And that's obviously the biggest concern. We don't see a lot of complications in children. In fact, I haven't, you know, really the literature is very sparse of anything from children. It's usually the older children. So heading into elementary school, you know, later elementary school, high school, and definitely college. Those are the areas that we should really be focusing on. You know, is there going to be enough with herd immunity that children won't need to be need to get the vaccine? I'm not exactly sure. But there has definitely been a shift, Melissa. I mean, we've seen this virus, which was mainly in the elderly population, now shift to the middle age. and we're now seeing it in children.
Mm-hmm.
So again, the children that are getting it is pretty, it's pretty minor. It's more like a mild flu. But there is definitely, you know, the possibility of getting worse complications. I think that's what we're sort of looking to do. The more we can get the adults vaccinated, you know, I think this becomes a time game where I think it's important that not only are we getting, you know, now we need to get vaccinated not just for our vulnerable elderly population who could die from this, but you know, we need to get vaccinated so we don't give it to our children.
True.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
And our children, again, are likely going to do fine, but there's always that small percentage.
Yeah.
You know, and we don't, you know, and that small percentage is just not, is not acceptable.
Well, Dr. Brown, when you tell me that the time is right for Chase to get vaccinated, I will call you.
Will do. Absolutely.
And we will talk in length about it. And no, I always appreciate it. You're so real and you give us such clarity. And I so appreciate your time. Thank you so much, Dr. Brown.
My pleasure.
All right.
And now, a few minutes with U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal on WICC 600.
Senator Blumenthal checking out Sikorsky this week. That was pretty cool. I saw some of the footage on News 12, and those choppers are awesome. What did you think?
They are awesome indeed. Amazing. You know, the CH-53K is called the heavy lift helicopter because it can transport stuff that weighs more, is bigger. It can transport not only equipment, but also troops, and it can rescue troops. So the CH-53K heavy lift is going to supplement the Black Hawk, which will continue to be produced there. As a member of the Armed Services Committee, I fight every year for additional Black Hawks and other kinds of helicopters, like the rescue helicopter that the Air Force uses, because they are so essential to our military, but they also have innumerable civilian uses in firefighting and so forth, particularly forest firefighting. And the kinds of helicopters produced by Sikorsky really make it the helicopter capital of the world. It produce the best helicopters anywhere.
Yeah, and I think I was hearing, Senator Blumenthal, something about how these new choppers for the Navy, they're like undetectable from the skies or something?
They are treated acoustically or in terms of their surface so that they are much less detectable in terms of radar. Not foolproof. They are not invisible to radar, but they are treated with the kind of stuff that makes them less visible.
That's so neat. And what I love is the fact that it's literally happening in our own backyard. So my question to you, Senator, did they give you any idea as to when these new choppers will be rolling out? How many, you know, anything like that?
They're going to be rolling out very, very soon. In fact, we saw the first to be manufactured in Bridgeport. The parts, as you might expect, come from all over the country. Mm-hmm. They are made in places all around the United States, but they are assembled, and the key parts, many of them, are made in Stratford at Sikorsky's plant there. So we saw the initial one. There are a number of others in production. We also saw the way that they make components like the blades and other key electronic features. And we also saw the new presidential helicopter, which is going to be really astonishing in its technological advance and also its sheer comfort for the President of the United States.
Amazing. Well, Senator Blumenthal, earlier this week, you also were one of the stronger voices talking about calling on GPS apps to keep trucks away from the Merritt Parkway. Now, you and I have talked about this on the show before because I've lived in Connecticut almost my entire life, born and raised here. I have seen it too many times to count, where trucks get on the Merritt Parkway or the Wilbur Cross highways and they get stuck under the tunnels. And almost every single time they say they're following GPS applications, which I understand. I, too, pretty much always use a GPS app. Why hasn't anything changed? Like, why hasn't that technology gotten better? Because you've made this call many times before.
I made the call about a year or more ago first to Google and Apple and others who have these apps. Remember that the apps essentially direct trucks like the rest of us around mm-hmm. traffic. If there's traffic on 95, it
right.
directs us to the Merrick. But the problem, as you say very correctly, is many of the trucks can't get under the bridges. And that serves nobody. A truck driver, correctly warned, would never go on the Merrick because getting stuck there doesn't really help him or her behind the wheel with a schedule to meet. And so I am calling again on these apps to include a very strong warning to the truck drivers or other commercial vehicles that they are banned from the Merrick with good reason. And that reason is very simply that the road wasn't designed for trucks, it's unsafe for them, and it's going to result in their being blocked and having to be backed off the Merrick. When one of those trucks is stuck, it creates traffic,
mm-hmm.
and the state police have to back it off the Merrick.
Well, and a lot of times, too, correct me if I'm wrong, the truck drivers also pay fines for that.
They pay a fine. It's mm-hmm. $92 per violation. The fine is real money, but it doesn't come close to the inconvenience and the cost of their delay because
sure.
truck drivers have to deliver their goods on time. They have a schedule. They
right.
have deadlines.
Right.
And there's also a cost to the state if there's damage to the overpass. In other words, if the truck
wrecks like the bridge or breaks something.
Overpass.
Yeah,
exactly.
That makes sense. Well, something else, Senator Blumenthal, that you have been talking about, and I so appreciate, holding social media sites accountable for fake COVID headlines specifically. Now, I want to just kind of take from my own personal perspective, because I have a husband who is obsessed with Twitter. I have a lot of friends who love Twitter. That's kind of their news source, to be honest. So I noticed, you know, when especially near the end of his term and the insurrection happened in Washington, D.C., I noticed that it took no time at all that I felt like Facebook, Twitter, many other social media sites blocked President Trump. So for whatever, you know, for good reason, I could understand no matter which side of the aisle you stand on. OK, so they blocked President Trump and they wanted to make sure that they weren't spreading hate. Fine. I don't understand, though, why we are still seeing so many fake headlines having to do with the COVID vaccine. We are noticing across the country, and it's no different here in Connecticut, that we've got this demographic of people 20s, 30s, and even 40s who won't get the COVID vaccine. I can't tell you how many people I have corrected on the safety of the vaccine, things like that, but they're referring to Twitter and articles that they've read. And I look at them and I'm like, this isn't even real. This doesn't even look good. Why aren't social media sites doing a better job of tracking fake COVID headlines? To me, I think it's actually deterring a big part of our population from getting vaccinated.
You're absolutely right, Melissa. And that's the reason why I am pressing to hold those sites more responsible. The tech platforms have a responsibility to avoid misinformation mm-hmm. and propaganda that they know is false and that actually harms people. This instance is only one of many where they have given voice and legitimacy to disinformation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they ought to be held more responsible for the kinds of practices that have become prevalent now. And what I have suggested is that there be a reduction in the immunity they have. They have a very broad protection and immunity from legal responsibility under a section of the law called Section 230.
Mm-hmm.
And I propose that there be some reforms in Section 230. So they have an incentive to do better.
Yeah. I just think it's interesting because, you know, it seemed like everyone was on the same page, had no trouble throwing President Trump under the bus, whether you like him or not. But, you know, we're living in a pandemic right now. And all we talk about, we hear it from our own president, you know, herd immunity, get your vaccine. And yet it's the millennials, it's my generation that are using these social media platforms most time to get their news. And they just don't have the right information. And I think that it's super irresponsible of these social media sites that they can totally nix something, but they're just going to ignore another thing. I think it's wrong.
The social media sites have a responsibility morally, and I think they ought to have a legal responsibility as well. Mm-hmm. That's why I'm working for reform. But in the meantime, people should know the vaccines are safe and effective. They are available increasingly easily at places like clinics, pharmacies, all kinds of sites around the state of Connecticut. It's easy, safe, effective, and you're helping your families and your coworkers as well as yourself.
Mm-hmm. Senator Blumenthal, always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.
All right.
Let's get wild. It's the Zoom Minute with Greg Dancho from Connecticut's Beardsley Zoo on Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600.
Okay, well, today is a very exciting day in our household, and I feel like it's the same in Greg Dancho's house as well. Today is National Zoo Lovers Day. Well, Greg, I mean, that just speaks to Chase's heart and many other animal lovers this morning. How do you feel on National Zoo Lovers Day today?
Well, we've got a beautiful day for National Zoo Lovers Day, don't we, today?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do.
Outside. Yeah, it's we know that people really enjoy zoos and our facilities, and we know that there's reasons for that, and we've seen that over many, many years. And one of them is it's an outing to get outside with your family and have a great day, you know, just in exploring and learning, and that's kind of the things that we at Connecticut Spirits Zoo really enjoy when we see our families coming out and enjoying our facility and learning about things. There's over 200 million visitors to zoos and aquariums around the country per year.
Mm-hmm.
So that's actually sometimes more than some of the sporting events that are out there. And so we see that tremendous amount of activity coming to us. Now, when I was growing up, we had seven kids in the family, and we were looking for things to do with my family, going out around. My father was a police officer in Stratford, and so we were looking for seven kids. What do you do with seven kids?
Oh, well, I know. I was one of five. Yes, it's hard. It's hard to figure that out. Yes.
I was the oldest of the seven. So we would go to the zoo on Sundays. Mm-hmm. That was our trip. We'd go to the zoo on a Sunday morning, and we'd go after church. And we spend a good morning, again, with seven kids. I think my family wanted us to get our exercise in and get us tired for the rest of the day. So, but I remember that. I remember that from, every day that we would go to the zoo, and my father would go in there, and we would go and look at the animals in the old monkey house. And I had that feeling back then that this is something I always wanted to do.
That's so cool.
With my life. And so I think this is one of the most important things for our facilities, is that we impact our children. And when children and families come to the zoo, and children get to get up close to see the tigers, and like Chase, you know, he does that all the time, right? When he sees those animals, there's a connection there. And that connection is vitally important for us. I think nowadays, even more so, to make that connection to the wild animals, to wild places, and then make that connection that these animals need our support.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because this, again, we've talked about this before. We really work with conservation with these endangered species. So Zoo Lovers Day coming to see, we want people to not only love the animals in our zoo, we want them to respect them. We want them to look at how we can help these animals in the future.
Totally.
And by visiting the zoo, you're helping that, because by coming to visit with us, we can use that revenue to, again, further our goals in conservation and education for those youngsters and the animals that are in our care.
Greg, let's talk about AZA accreditation, because, you know, you just said 200 million people across our country go to zoos and aquariums every single year, which is astonishing. It's a beautiful beautiful thing, and I agree that there's something really special about the connection you make with animals. Unfortunately, though, all aquariums in all zoos are not AZA accredited. Right. So why get the accreditation, and what makes you guys stand out if you are AZA approved?
Well, here's the numbers that come out. There's over 2,500 institutions or facilities in the country that can call themselves as an aquarium. They can get a USDA license, and you do the minimal care for those animals, and you can open a zoo. You don't have to have any of those things that we talk about for Connecticut Spirit Zoo, like the education, the conservation, the guest experience, and the research. Those are the four tenets that we use for AZA accreditation. There are only 240 institutions in the country that are accredited. So out of the 2,500 places that can call themselves a zoo, only 240 of them are accredited. We're one of those, along with Mystic and Maritime Aquarium in Connecticut. And what's important about that is because we go really look hard at those tenants. We really look hard at the conservation and the guest experience and the education and the research. And we are doing this for the goals for animal welfare, to take care of these animals for the future. Mm-hmm. It's not something we're doing for the money. We're not doing this to raise tons of cash as a for-profit institution, because we're not. This is something that we have as an avocation to make sure these animals are on our planet, and make sure these animals stick around for the next generation. I want my grandchildren to be able to see these animals. I want these to appreciate these animals, and even to love these animals. Mm-hmm. As National Zoo lovers, it is the love that people have for animals that why we have this day. So these are the important things. This, for accreditation, we have to go through a rigorous accreditation process to be accredited. It's really a year long process just to get the application in, the inspection that we have, then go to the accreditation commission. So this is not something we take very lightly at all. This is very, very important for us that we are adhering to the goals of why people should love zoos.
Mm-hmm.
We should love zoos for the reasons that a lot of people don't think about those things, about the research and about the conservation. It is a great day. Like I said, why do people come to zoos? Great day out with the family, get to see some magnificent creatures, and then have a great day. However, what we really want people to understand is the underlying things that we do, the animal welfare, the research that we do on making sure that we can do the better for these animals every day. The evolution of zoos over the last 80 years has been tremendous, and it's something that we're really, really proud of.
Yeah, it's so true. I mean, and it is a vigorous process to get the AZA accreditation, but my gosh, it's so worth it. It's amazing.
Yeah, and one of the things that I'd be remiss to say that a lot of people, zoo lovers, again, National Zoo Lover Day today, I have to express my love to our guests and supporters that have been tremendous with us and over this past year and helped us out. And also I have to put a big shout out to Jack Hanna, who they reported yesterday that he's not going to be doing any more public appearances.
Yes.
Due to health reasons. And people know about Jack, and I've known Jack. This little group of zoo people that we work with is very, very small. When you look at 240 institutions, mm-hmm. we're a big family.
Yeah.
And so we know everybody. And Jack is a great friend of mine. Has been a great friend of the zoo and aquarium community, and we do send our well wishes to mm-hmm. him and his family. It's again, he's done a tremendous amount of work mm-hmm. to further the goals of what we do in zoos and what we do for conservation and education. So again, our condolences and prayers sent out to Jack.
Yeah, we talked about Jungle Jack this morning on the show, and I said, you know, Greg Dancho, in my opinion, you are kind of like our Connecticut Jungle Jack, because to me, well, you know, you look at somebody who, he was with the Columbus Zoo, he was the director there, my gosh, from the 70s to the 90s. He's done so many appearances on television, and to me, Greg, you know, like, you're an advocate for the state of Connecticut when it comes to animals, and to me, that's kind of like how Jack Hanna is. I mean, he truly is, has done so much work, and in his news of the dementia yesterday was devastating. So I appreciate your words on that. Thank you so much.
And thank you for your words also. Have a great day. National Zoo Lovers Day. We hope to see some people out today. Beautiful day to come out. And again, take a look at our website, take a look at our Facebook page, and see all the wonderful things that Connecticut Spirits Zoo is doing.
Love that. Sounds really good. Thank you, Greg. We appreciate it.
All right. Have a great day.
You too.